Hello and welcome to Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today we have Jill Murray and Corey May as our guests. Corey was a writer on Prince of Persia, The Warrior Within, and its sequel, The Two Thrones, as well as Batman Arkham Origins. He was the lead writer on Assassin's Creed 1, 2, and 3, the director of screenwriters at Alice, Ubisoft Storytelling Studio, and is currently the narrative director at Certain Affinity. Jill was a writer on Your Shape Fitness Evolved and also the Assassin's Creed series, including Liberation, Black Flag, and Freedom Cry. She's had two young adult novels published and is currently working on a bunch of unannounced and unannounced projects through her firm, Disco Globe Interactive. Thanks for coming here, you two.
Thanks for having me.
So
our first question will be, how did the both of you get into the industry? We know both of you have told this story a lot, so it can be brief, but we think they're worth telling again just because of how interesting your journeys have been.
Sure. I'll try and keep it short as best I can. It was a very strange way in, at least for me. I had started out after I graduated college, went to grad school for film producing. And after finishing up grad school, started up a film production company and set up a couple of movies, was going through the typical process of, you know, living in Hollywood, a lot of stuff in development hell, and had signed with the William Morris Agency, which is now William Morris Endeavor. And this was probably 2002, 2003. It's been a long time. So I'm sorry if I have the dates a little off. And what was apparently happening around that time is publishers and developers were reaching out to agencies looking for writers for games. And I guess most of the people at the agency at the time weren't particularly interested in any of the opportunities. I don't know why. Maybe it had to do with money, maybe because people didn't like video games. I have no idea. But I've always loved games. And when our agent told us about some of the things coming through, I basically said, I don't care if we have to pay them. This is an opportunity to get involved with making video games. And took a couple of small jobs to get my feet wet that were very strange and slightly unpleasant experiences, but I met a lot of cool people, some of whom I am still friends with. And after, I don't know, about a year of doing that, met up with some people from Ubisoft to actually talk to them about turning one of their properties into an animated TV show. And the conversation ended with them saying, not really interested in this, but kind of like you, why don't you come up to our Montreal studio, meet the people up there and see if there's a way for us to work together. So it was all very casual and strange, but exciting at the same time. So flew up to Montreal and I was really excited because back then you could still smoke inside. So I really liked the city for that. And just met a bunch of people up there and randomly started working on the Prince of Persia franchise. And while I was there, became friendly with Patrice, who was a creative director there, who had worked on Sands of Time, and slowly moved on to working on AC with him. And it just sort of grew from there. And I started out as a contractor. I was traveling back and forth a lot between LA and Montreal. And after a couple of years, I just sort of said, fuck it, and stayed up there full time and stayed there, I don't know, almost 11, 12 years. And that's how I got started, at least.
Awesome. Before we get to Jill, I want to ask, are studios still looking at agencies for writers, or did that just drop off?
I've, at least when I was doing work with Alice, there were definitely agents that were sending out writing samples, resumes, stuff like that. I don't know if Jill has had similar experience, but it's still a mixed bag. I also think that as time has gone on, more and more people are now working in the space, so there are other ways to find writers. So, yeah.
Oh, I was just going to add, I've talked to agents who are sort of interested in representing whole teams of people to make a game together, but not so much specifically for game writing. So that would be more something that if someone already had an agent for film or TV, that maybe if they understood games, they would be sending stuff out, but I don't think it's probably the most common way people are getting in touch with the industry.
How'd you get into the industry, Jill?
Yeah. I studied theater production in university, And I graduated, that was like my bachelor's degree. I graduated in 2000, which was right about the same time as the internet was becoming what it is today. And so when I graduated from theater school, I actually went to work for myself as an independent web developer. So that's something I did for actually about 11 years, everything from design to code. But the clients you come across in web development are not always that awesome. Like, you're interested in accessibility and facilitating communication between people and machines, and they just want to know, like, can it be blue? And you're like, yes, it can be blue. And they're like, no, but really, can it be very blue? And it just kind of, it's a little unsatisfying. So I started looking for other creative outlets, and I'd never written fiction before, so I started writing novels. And I did that at the same time as I was a web developer. And I got my novels published also at just a massively transitional time. The first one came out in 2008, which just coincides almost exactly with like the consolidation of all the bookstores and the rise of Amazon. And I was seeing more experienced novelists who had long careers. Suddenly they couldn't count on advances anymore. They would get like one advance for $30,000, the next advance for $5,000. And I sort of became aware really quickly that there wasn't going to be a way, a reliable way to develop that into a career. And this is about the same time that I was really, I'd really had enough of the web development. I was kind of like, what am I going to do? And I had always liked video games, but I'm pretty hard on myself. And when I wanted to write novels, I kind of was like, well, I could either have Civilization on my PC or I could be a novelist, but I'm obviously never going to be able to do both because I would just like to play video games and not do my work. So I kind of lost touch with games just out of like trying to maintain two careers simultaneously. But what ultimately ended up happening was I sent myself on a research trip to Ethiopia because I wanted to write an adventure novel about rival coffee traders on a mission to find and steal a rare plant. And my Ethiopia trip kind of got interesting when my passport was confiscated and they wanted to put me in jail on suspicion of working illegally in the construction industry. So I did not quite get the research I intended to do done. And I came home very like tired and confused and broke. And my boyfriend at the time was kind of like, well, as long as you're just going to be sitting here catatonic on the couch, why don't we find some video games that you can play while you sit here? And so it was about like halfway through Mass Effect 2 that it suddenly dawned on me, like, wait a minute, there's a lot of text in video games. Like, someone has to be writing this. And they're probably writing it down the street because I just happen to be a Montrealer. And all of this turned out to be true. They were actually making Mass Effect 3 down the street from my apartment. But so because I was in Montreal and there's so much industry there, I was able quite easily to just go out and meet people and also use Twitter. And before long, I met a woman, a writer, Anne LeMay, who had been working on Your Shape and was leaving that project to work on something else. And she didn't really want to leave her team writerless, and so she recommended me, and I was able to kind of successfully argue that from like the dance writing that I'd done for my novels, there was a connection there to physical fitness. And so they brought me on for Your Shape Fitness Evolved 2012. And that is how I got into the industry.
Since you both have written stuff in other mediums besides video games, what does writing a video game specifically, like what type of itch does it scratch for you that you don't get anywhere else?
So, you know, the majority of the writing I've done has been in the game space. When I was working in film, it was more as a producer, and there was some writing to lay the groundwork. I think, though, for me, one of the biggest differences is that you get to spend a great deal more time with both the world and the characters that you're working with inside the game space, at least. I have no experience in either really television or novels, and maybe Jill can speak to that in terms of book writing, because I think that it would be closer to those mediums, both of which have, you know, more generous time constraints, I suppose, and the ability to let characters live and breathe and grow and develop. Whereas when you're dealing with something that's 90 to 120 minutes, you really have to narrow your scope and field. And I also like the idea with games that you are working hand in hand with the player to uncover narrative a lot of times, whereas in most other mediums, aside from a few experiments that I've seen in the film and novel space, it's usually a fairly fixed path. So there's not as much room to hide stuff or to encourage exploration and discovery, not just of a world, but of the narrative that's being created.
And Jill?
I've definitely seen similarities most between, you know, sort of the big cinematic games and novels, like Corey said, for the amount of time that you spend in the world and with the character. I also think that just with reading, like the simple input of turning the page makes books more like games than movies are. Where your mind is still active, of course, when you're watching a film, but you're not confirming your decision to keep going as often. So I find that interesting. I guess why I like games and why I'm not just continuing to write novels apart from the financial problem that literary fiction has is that I see myself really as more of a tinkerer. I like design. I like all kinds of art and working with different materials. I like code. And so now, especially that I'm on my own with my own company working on projects of a lot of different sizes, I get to sort of tinker with design more often and the connection between, what the player is doing, and the story is close, and I get to be closer to it in that way. I was talking to a dramaturge recently, and she described the role of the dramaturge in theater as being an audience advocate. And I thought, well, that's really kind of like baked into the job description for a game designer or a game writer, that you have to be a player advocate. And I enjoy that aspect of it also.
Do you both like writing? Do you enjoy the process?
The answer is yes and no. It depends. Every day is different. When things are working, when I'm happy with what I'm doing, when I feel like I'm actively creating something interesting, it's great. And then there are other days where I wind up full of, you know, doubt and uncertainty, and I figure everything is terrible and I have no idea what I'm doing. Then it's pretty awful. So it's inconsistent at best. And when it's good, it's great. And when it's not, it's upsetting. And something that's even more recent is I've started second guessing myself a lot more, I think, than I used to, which I suppose can be both a good thing and a bad thing. So no easy answer.
Why do you think you're second guessing yourself more now?
I don't know. I find myself, just as I've done more, I think back to, you know, what worked, what didn't, always trying to apply lessons. And so it just makes me wind up thinking more and more than I probably used to. And so I'm trying to strike a balance between getting everything out, staying in, you know, a zone as I go, and I can, you know, save the reflection and reconsideration for later, rather than doing it in real time, because sometimes that can turn into paralysis.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not an easy answer for me. No simple answer, at least.
And I want to hear Jill's answer to this part of this question too, but do you have any, not like coping mechanisms, but ways you get through writing No Man's Land to power through to get like a momentum going again?
Oh. Sorry,
Jill, were you going to go? Go for it.
No, I just sighed. Anyway, go ahead.
So there's lots, you know, there's the standard, which is drinking. I also find that I'll take something if it's particularly problematic and just sort of stick it back up into my head. The new thing that I've started doing is running through stuff either while walking or smoking or falling asleep at night. I'll often try, and this is going to sound really weird, but it's something that I do, is I'll try and tell myself a story as I go to sleep. And a lot of times, if there's something that's particularly tricky that I'm working on, I will try and and go through it while I'm sleeping. And it'll almost be like this brute force effort where I'll start telling myself a version of events and see how far I can get down the road before I either become disgusted with myself or fall asleep. And it's proved kind of useful. And sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and while I'm taking a shower, the answer will come to me. So it's an interesting process, but it's kind of working. But I would definitely vote drinking as number one when it comes to coping.
Would you agree, Jill?
I'm the opposite. I can't do any writing at all with any alcohol. Like the first second it touches my tongue, a switch is thrown in my brain that's like, all right, we're done. We're on vacation. So I kind of try to, I don't know, maintain good hygiene the rest of the time so that my brain can't get too caught up in itself. So like I'll start the day with half an hour of yoga, like a big hippie, and I try to get a reasonable amount of exercise. I take a lot of showers when I need to think, like maybe 5 in one day if necessary. I can't remember who said it, but I always like the quotation that I like having written. Like, I don't know, like, I'm very fidgety, and so just, like, learning to write long things like novels and games was as much a matter of just, like, setting a timer and making myself sit in one place for, like, the amount of times, and then just being like, you know, the time is going to pass so much faster if you're writing, if you're not writing. And I feel like I had the advantage of learning to do that before, before broadband was a thing.
What's the both your writing processes like when you both start writing in the day?
My process is really dictated by my clients. And because I'm not working on one big game and I'm working on many small games, it means that my week is broken up into a lot of meetings and I have to switch tracks very frequently from one project to the next. So I kind of just like cross my fingers and hope for the best and I'm very good at working in whatever time is present. Like when I was working on my novels, I basically worked on a glorified Palm Pilot. And if I was like in a waiting room or on a train or had like 5 minutes, I was able to like focus for 5 minutes and get the work done. And that's something that's still serving me now. But I don't have like a consistent writing ritual where I get my coffee and sit down and take a deep breath. And then, you know, I work on the problem and the inspiration comes. You just kind of like just never give up hacking away at things until they make sense. And for me, it only starts to flow when I can feel the characters. So I have to like really kind of tap into my own emotions. And once I can feel what the characters are doing, then I know everything's going to be okay. But arriving at that point where you have that, like an almost living human connection with fictional characters is can be a bit stressful waiting for that to kick in.
I think that's the more common stance to be in than I don't think I've ever felt calm or happy writing something. I've always been super stressed out.
Yeah, but I call all of the waiting and trying and not quite getting there, that's all writing too. Like if you're putting in the time to do all of the awkward, nasty stuff that feels terrible, that's still writing. You can't just count like your writing time as the time when the words were coming out and it was going properly. Like all of the disaster, all of the meetings, all of it's writing.
It's still hard to justify, like to explain that to people and have them actually believe you.
It is, no, it's like impossible. It is actually impossible. People are not going to understand that ever.
Corey, what's your process like?
I mean, I agree with pretty much everything Jill said. It feels very similar. Just like her, there's no ritual. What I'll sometimes try and do, because even I start to worry about, you know, I agree that a big part or just as much of the process is the time it takes to get to the point where you feel good about what you're writing down. And that's just a matter of time. And I'm not a particularly fast person. And I feel like that's not necessarily a particularly fast part of the process or one that we can even have that much control over. It just takes time for the world, for the characters to take root inside of you. It's really hard to hold an entire other person inside. And sometimes we're asked to do it with several at once and very quickly. So there's a real challenge there. One of the things I'm trying to do more of is I'll just sit down and start writing a bunch of shit. Like I'll just go, not really think about what's coming out. hope that there's something there that may be useful later. If not, I'll toss it. But I found that, you know, even some of the stuff that's total and utter nonsense, there'll be a sentence or two that becomes useful that I'll cut out, set aside. It'll help form a foundation. It'll spark an idea, things like that. I haven't reached the point, even though I keep telling myself that I kind of want to start, if not carrying a notebook, doing something with my iPhone or iPad, because every now and then you'll have these lightning bolts of, I don't know if inspiration is the right word. It's almost just like a tiny glimpse at something that makes sense for once. And I try and remember them all, or I'll like run someplace to jot it down before it disappears. But yeah, I have no real process either. You hope, or at least I hope, that there are moments where I'll get into a groove and be able to write. And then there are other times where you're just waiting and hoping. Yeah.
When you do get into a groove and you've built up some good momentum, do you have any ways that you try to keep that going and not burn out really fast?
It's similar to the thing I do when I don't have the momentum, is I'll just keep going. If it feels like the train is about to come off the tracks, I'll try and ignore it and just keep saying, you know, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. And eventually, though, what'll happen more often than not is I'll need a cigarette. And that overpowers everything else. So once the nicotine needs to get inside of me, then it all disappears.
For me, it's kind of like when you have a good dream and you realize that you have a good dream is when it ends and you can't get back into it.
Yes.
Because when I'm on a good sprint, I don't know what's happening until I realize, oh, this feels really good. And then I lose it.
Sometimes it's awful, actually, to be in the flow. I wrote some, I can't like say what I was writing because it would give away too much about the plot and whatever that we're not supposed to reveal yet. But I was writing this thing earlier this year. And it was like, I'd had a rough year. I've like processed a bunch of loss. I also had like two breakups. And then I sat down to write this thing that had some similar themes. And it was like the easiest thing in the world to write. And I just sat down. But it was like, I sat at my desk and just like, I just typed and wept continuously, silently for like a week. And then I handed it in and they liked it. But then they had questions. And I had been just so in it while I was writing that by the time I like went there and got to the meeting and sat down to answer the questions, I couldn't remember anything I had actually done. And I had to like step away and like take some time to like reread it analytically. And it's almost like, who wrote this? I don't know. It was good though. It was good what I wrote. I just don't remember what I did.
Has it happened with anything else you've written?
Thank God, no. Like, I don't really, that wouldn't be my preference for how to live. But like, you take what you get when you have a deadline.
Have you ever written stuff where you don't feel that good about, but then when you look back on it, that you're like, oh man, how did I actually write this? This is really good. I'm not that good.
Yes, it happens all the time. If I'm lucky, right? A lot of times I'll just look back and be like, yep, it's as bad or if not worse. And then other times it seems to have happened by accident, if it's actually turned out okay.
I hate a lot of my old work, and that could include things from like last Tuesday. But I've had the experience a lot of like, I'll write a first draft, and then the client just takes it and records it. And they were like, but it was good. I'm like, but there were questions I had that I wanted time to go over on the second draft that was scheduled. And they're like, no, it's in the can. When I was working on Assassin's Creed Liberation with Richard Furries, I would write a line and I'd be like, no, that's too cheesy, and I would cut it, and then I would come back to discover that he had basically like taken it out of the garbage and put it back into the script. He'd be like, but I like that line, and then and like sometimes you just have to trust. Luckily, sometimes there are other people that you can trust to like tell you when things are not garbage.
Yeah. If either of you had unlimited time on your projects, would you always just keep rewriting what you've written, or would you know when to stop?
I think I know when to stop.
Oh, you would?
Yeah. Because when you write novels, you get so sick of things that you have to move on.
I don't think I would ever know.
Yeah, that's the problem I would have, and I feel that way about games in general. I think that if you gave most teams, or said to most teams they had unlimited time, they'd never release anything.
That's true.
you know, it's a rare person that has a discipline, I think, or at least that's been my experience. Because I don't know if other people go through this as well. I can't play anything I've worked on once it's in a box. I can play it when it's in development because I figure, oh, well, there's still time. And once it's on the disc, all I see is everything that either could have been or that I hate. And it's also like listening to yourself talk, which is really, at least for me, a bizarre and uncomfortable thing. So it's always been a challenge. And you always wish, or at least I always wish I had more time.
This just reminds me of Eric Wolpaw when he was working on Psychonauts. Hated listening to his writing so much that when he's playtesting the game, he would play it in other languages just so you didn't have to listen to his writing at all.
I feel that. It's really hard. At least for me, it's really, really hard. And I wind up, I just, you know that, it's like when your face flushes from being embarrassed. If I see someone playing something I've worked on, that's what happens. I like can't be in
there. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't wish I had more time. I just like wish I was better. Like, could I just not be embarrassing? That would be nice.
Speaking of having a lot of time, when you are working on long projects and sort of spread too thin, how do you keep yourself creatively refreshed? Do you like devour new things on the side, or do you just go back to your old favorites?
Neither. I find, like, personally, I find it's really important for me to stick to like real life habits, like making dinner and eating properly and talking to real life humans. I'm more likely to prioritize those things over any kind of media consumption, especially now. This, I think, just something I've learned the hard way. What crunch does to me, it feels like it's going to take like 30 years off my life that I would much rather spend baking.
It's always different. I'm always consuming media. It's maybe a problem. So I watch a lot of television. I read and I play a lot of games. And I'll replay. This is what's really interesting, is I'll replay old games all the time. But it's very rare that I'll go back and rewatch a film or reread a book or rewatch a TV show. I don't know why. The exception is The West Wing, which I tend to watch once a year. I'm at season 5 right now on my yearly rewatch of it. I don't know why.
Corey, I saw you do an interview before where, I don't know if you still do this, but you would find media that you don't have to pay 100% attention to. And so you'd like play a game on your iPad and then also have a TV show going on at the same time.
Yes.
Do you still do that?
I do still do it. I absolutely do it. If I could take a picture right now, you'd see that I'm on the laptop talking to you and my iPad is on a stand right next to me. Because what I'll probably do when we're done is I've gotten back into Diablo 3. And I'll probably watch some West Wing while I'm leveling up my Season 5 character. And I do it a lot with JRPGs, especially ones that are very thin on story where you just have to focus on grinding. And so I played a ton of the Etrian Odyssey games on my 3DS while watching TV. Yeah, I still do it. I don't know why, but I like it.
Jill, do you also multitask while you play?
Yeah, right now I have a lot of primary tasks, and I've been having trouble finding mobile games that I'm really into, so I've been doing it less. But like, when Animal Crossing New Leaf came out, I played like 193 hours of that game. Like, I was just never not playing it. Almost, so anything I was watching, I was playing. Until one day, I couldn't look at it anymore. And I can't turn it on without feeling slightly nauseated. Like, the game, it worked and it worked and it worked and it worked. And then just one day, it was over. So, yeah.
I know that feeling where you're just like, I'm over it. There's like a day where you just stop.
It was just like physically couldn't do it anymore. It was just like a switch again. Just like, nope, that time of our life is over and we can stop worrying about that fruit mortgage. Jesus.
The one thing that's really hard for me is writing with anything going on around me. I'll often have to do it either at night or on the weekends, and I can't listen to music. It's you'll see artists, for example, making art while watching or streaming stuff or listen. I can't even listen to music when I'm
I get so jealous of that.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I don't. Maybe I'll try it. I don't know what would happen. I don't think I could do it. I would just start to procrastinate and then watch or listen to the music. I've heard that if you play music where you know the lyrics or something that you're extremely familiar with, it can work. But I can't imagine that working for me.
I do music with no lyrics, or I do music that relates to the project, so it puts me into the time or place of the project. That got a little. I sort of damaged that habit a little bit when I wrote a book situated within really terrible R&B group that I was listening to on purpose, a lot of really bad pop R&B. I kind of like broke the one mechanism I had that worked reliably.
Do either of you have problems with procrastinating?
Of course.
Procrastinating isn't a problem. Come on.
It's kind of true though, because if you think about it, everything has the potential to be relevant, right? It's exactly. Not like we're
as a day. That's a good excuse to tell yourself.
That's so that's such a dangerous slope.
The other thing though, there are things sometimes when your brain is stuck. It's that. I'm not a scientist, so I'm gonna like explain this completely wrong. But there is like part of your brain that just wants to do motor things, and it will get in your way when you're trying to be creative. And if you give it something motor to do, you can unblock the rest of your brain. I had a tap dance teacher that demonstrated this by showing us like an intricate sequence of steps, and then. As we were learning it, he started just tossing a bouncy ball at us. And so part of your brain was just concentrating on catching this bouncy ball and sending it back to him. And then suddenly, like, it was way easier to learn and do all those steps. So I think, like, if you're procrastinating and you're like, oh, suddenly I just have this, like, driving need to do the laundry, you know, it doesn't have to be a bad thing because there's like you're preoccupying that motor part of your brain that just wants to do stuff.
I was going to say that it seems like the only way that writers clean their place is when they're trying to get out of doing writing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's weird. I would suspect and just like Jill, don't have the science to back me up, but I don't know that we were designed or evolved with this kind of behavior in mind. So in some ways, I often feel like we're fighting an instinct when we sit down to do nothing except write.
Yeah.
It's not what we were, I don't know, we're not supposed to do that, right? We're supposed to like run around and hunt animals and survive being eaten by other ones.
Do you turn off the internet when you write, you two?
No, I can't.
I always need to research something. Like, once in a while, I'll use one of those apps like Freedom that lets you knock things out for 20 minutes at a time. Like, if I'm having a really hard time, I'll do that. But not consistently. Like, I think we just, like all people, not just writers, the way our society and our technology works, we just have to learn how to live with it. Like, we're not going to be able to just turn it off. We have to be able to learn to coexist and still get our shit done, like with our world happening around us.
It's a good thing to aspire to. Going to switch topics a bit. Since you've both been narrative directors and writers, has the macro view affected your writing process at all?
Like my situation is bizarre because I ran my own business like from before I was out of school. So from like 1998 to 2011, and then I worked as an employee in AAA Game Company for 4 years, and then I went back to working for myself. And I think that having, like, it's natural to me to consider the whole business at all times, no matter what position I'm in, and certainly for novelists, especially at the time when I started writing. You're expected to be thinking about marketing and the bottom line and your social media profile. And so I feel like I've never been far from the macro view, so I don't really see... I think there's a difference for me between the two states.
Do you wish that you sometimes knew less, though?
No.
Okay. Never mind.
I wish that I had understood this about myself earlier, because it could have helped me explain myself better to people I was working with. It could have helped me avoid some conflicts, or to sometimes understand why people think it's weird that I'm concerned about so many things outside my immediate job. But I think it's just natural to my mind to want to fit everything together and see everything and know everything. And then, like, once I really understand how everything is supposed to work, that's the point when I feel comfortable producing, because I know why I'm doing what I'm doing, exactly how it's going to benefit everything. And like, that's just what I need to make myself comfortable, is macro everything.
And Corey?
Yeah, I mean, similar to what Jill had said, I feel like even assuming things are going well, even when you're working as a writer, there is still, if not an expectation, a need to be aware of the bigger picture. And so that's always been true, the need to be collaborative and considerate of other points of view. I think what's been most interesting for me is that as I move from a position of pure content creation to facilitating content creation, I've tried to be more thoughtful and sensitive with the way that feedback is presented, just knowing what it's like being on the receiving end. And so that's been helpful, at least to a certain degree. But yeah, in general, I think that just given the collaborative nature of games, especially when the teams are very large, you try to always maintain a big picture view of things rather than stay locked away in a silo. And so I don't know that the evolution of the job has changed how I perceive things so much as it's just changed my day-to-day, you know, and what's expected of me and what I need to do. There's a lot, I would say, that where it used to be 75% content creation and 25% everything else, it's now closer to a 50-50 split. And then the days get a little bit longer because I think a lot of times there is stuff that goes on outside of the office, or at least outside of normal business hours, that requires work as well, which I think is also true when you're writing. At least for me, I'm not the kind of person that when the day ends, I'm done working, right? When I'm on a project, it's stuck in my head until forever. I was going to say until ship, but that's not
true. No.
It's there forever and ever until the day you die. So...
Yeah,
it never ends or goes away.
You're still working on the first Assassin's Creed?
Yeah, I think about it. I think about everything I've worked on probably every week at some point. Yeah, it comes up. It never goes away, at least for me. Maybe I other people are good at letting things go or setting things aside, but clearly I'm not.
I had an academic contact me with, like, she was writing about something I'd worked on, and she had additional questions about a character, and I was like, cool, and I started answering questions, and then I realized that the way I was answering the questions, I was answering with stuff that wasn't in the game, which meant that I was essentially still writing the character. And then I was like, okay, I think... That's when I stopped answering the questions. I'm like, okay, I think I've given you enough information. We'll have to, like, at some point, let the work speak for itself.
Actually, with Jill, I'm curious, has your work in theater translated to your work in games at all?
It's starting to. For a while there, it really seemed like I was just jumping from one thing to the next, kind of like schizophrenically, and that there was no connection, and that I was just abandoning things and then moving on to other things. But, actor that I worked with on games put me in touch last year with the National Theatre School of Canada, and they have an extraordinary playwriting program where they take in only 2 students a year, and I got to go in last year and then again this year and do workshops in making games with their playwriting students, And it went pretty well, and it was also, the workshop was also picked up by the Playwrights Workshop of Montreal. And so now that I'm working with all these theater people more and more and making connections with them, and I'm seeing that theater is becoming more and more interested in, I guess, like social interactivity and in ways of using things like games to make, you know, more interesting and experimental theater experiences. So I can kind of see things fusing back together. And then just, of course, anything you've learned always feeds into your work. You don't necessarily know how. But I know that, like, I have in my mind certain assumptions about, you know, blocking and use of space. And I'm sure that plays into how I write. I should add, like, I was never a playwriting student. I studied design and production. I was going to design scenery and costumes. So it's all connected, just not necessarily in a direct way that you would think.
Are you not necessarily conscious of it when you're writing or working a narrative?
No, sometimes I'm conscious of it when I'm having conversations with people. I find this is something I find with games a lot. Games can get quite insular, and I think maybe because a lot of the people working in games don't come from they've kind of ended up in an art field, but not coming from an arts background. So they haven't had the education that teaches them that they are creative and that they have a place in history amongst other creatives. And here are all the ways all these other mediums have solved problems. I do notice people in games sometimes reinventing the wheel or just like putting in a lot of time and effort to rediscover something that they could have just borrowed from another medium. And they just don't, they have no way of knowing that it's out there. So I definitely notice the theater thinking in that way sometimes when I'm talking to people. And I try to just like put people in touch with resources that they can find elsewhere to maybe like lighten the load a little bit.
Have you noticed that, Corey?
Yeah, to a certain degree. Yeah. So for me, and I don't know if, I think it's connected to what Jill is talking about. I think there's been a sort of a perception problem from a lot of people in the game space that they continue to treat what we create as software rather than entertainment. Mm-hmm. And you see it in the way that things are staffed or prioritized, or again, like Jill was saying, people's points of reference. And I think that's a challenge. And I don't think it's true everywhere. And I would argue that probably the more successful publishers and developers are the ones that are more quickly realizing that we are in a creative field, that we are creating first and foremost entertainment and not software in the traditional sense, right? Where our competition is not Microsoft Excel or Word or an email program. It's great works of art.
Yeah.
So the sooner we can get everyone to realize that at a fundamental level, I think the better off we will be.
But it's getting better.
It's always getting better. It's always getting better. Although, what's interesting is that you see more ambitious attempts from upwards of 20 years ago, and we're only now starting to return to that space, I think. That the world that could have been born out of a better reception for or a larger name for the things that came from Looking Glass Studios, for example, I think we'd be in a very different place right now. And a lot of times it feels like those things are just now being rediscovered, which is really interesting.
Huh.
The focus on player agency, right? And
yeah.
And the world as a toy / tool / bastion of opportunity. So it's interesting to me, at least, and that may just be a reflection of the fact that we've been experimenting and discovering, right? The industry is young, but it's not as young, I think, as we like to say, right? We're going on now, what is it, 30 or 40 years? So yes, it's new, but it's not like it just started yesterday.
And people keep bringing up the analogy to film and how, compared to film, we're still an early industry. They didn't know what they were doing at this stage. And I feel like that should be less and less useful these days, or people should just stop saying it so much.
Yes. And I think that film is still experimenting all the time as well. I don't know that there's necessarily something wrong either with being in a place of discovery. I think it leads to more opportunities than it does pitfalls. Yeah. So a lot of times it's cast as being something very negative rather than embracing it as something that's exciting and more focused on experimentation and not knowing for sure, you know, what's around the next corner.
And speaking of film, Corey, you said that you hope to dissolve the cutscene gameplay structure that so many video games rely on. So for both of you, why is it so hard to break away from that structure? And like, why doesn't pure gameplay work all the time? Or just what are we doing? Jill, do you have an answer since you laughed?
I'm laughing because that was like a, I don't know, kind of like an octopus of a question.
Do you think we'll always be there'll always be cutscenes?
I hope not. I mean, here's something. I think that games have a lot to learn from dance. Dance has been telling stories for hundreds of years without words, or cutscenes, and that like choreographers, the way they work, they manage to arrive at discovery through the movement, and not even necessarily from a sense of like, how am I going to communicate the movement, just of like, what does the movement feel like, and how, you know, to me while I'm making it. And I feel like if we kind of situate the player inside the creative production process instead of sitting them outside it and presenting everything to them, I think that we'll find our answers maybe a lot faster, or just have a more fun time doing it. I think it's easy to evaluate what's in a cutscene. Like, was that line cool? Did the dude look badass? Like, it's easy to evaluate a cutscene on those terms. It's hard to understand how, like, all of the branches of movement and decision-making and interaction are working together, and it's uncomfortable to let go of that. Improvisational theater, too, also has a lot to offer on the subject of letting go. So I don't have clear answers, but I don't see how we can just keep having cutscenes. It's boring everybody.
Is it?
I think, so, like, almost everybody at some point, like, people, when you're trying to, you know, I'm sure every writer on a game has had this experience of trying to work on the game, but at some point being treated like someone who just wants to shove movies into games and isn't really focused on play. And that can get really frustrating when you are focused on play and don't personally need cutscenes. So I think probably for writers, cutscenes are frustrating. A lot of players skip right over the cutscenes. When I'm playing games, I don't always appreciate them. Sometimes I do. It really depends on the content. But I think the idea of you play and then you have story and then you play and then you have story, it's kind of archaic, and it just expresses a discomfort between maybe like processing information and acting at the same time. And like, I don't know. Ties into all kinds of crazy ideas I have about movement and expression and how people are cut off from those things. Yeah. Sorry, I'm totally rambling.
That was still a good answer. Corey, what are your thoughts?
I think Jill hit the nail on the head. I think a big part of the reason we haven't seen as much forward movement in that regard has to do with control. And control and fear, or the fear of giving up that control to either sharing responsibility with the player. Sometimes it's a financial consideration. I've often heard the argument of, you can't spend money to create these assets or these experiences and then tell me that the player may not find or see or appreciate them.
Yeah.
And it's something I completely disagree with, especially because one of the things that drives me with any kind of media is the notion of exploration and discovery, right? So I like that both from a mechanical and narrative point of view. So it's just going to be a challenge. I also think the other thing that tends to happen is people will move into a production, and I've seen this time and time again, you know, with the there will be no cutscenes mandate. And maybe it's a genuine shared desire, and then you run out of time, and or you run out of resources, and you fall back on what you know, because it's not always the time for experimentation and exploration and taking chances, which is something that has to be done, especially at places where that kind of approach to game production is new, right? It's new, it's scary, it's not something people are used to. It's not something that everyone can say with certainty they know what'll come out the other end. And so it's going to take time. And what I think you need is just more and more advocates for it, whether it's people that can say, just reassure and say, don't worry, I know what I'm doing, everything will be fine in the end. Or if it's people that have more experience in creating those types of experiences saying, trust me, I've done this before, it worked out fine. And then there's also being willing to let go of that. And I think it's a very bizarre fear, especially in this day and age where so much is shared online. You've created content and it's not on the main path. If it was up to me, there would be no main path. I'd love to see a game with no golden path, a game that just drops you into a world. Or if there's dozens of golden paths rather than one, and you get to decide what your golden path is. I think Bethesda is getting closer and closer. The Fallout 4 was a little bit different for me in that regard because they seemed to move back towards something a little more traditional with voice protagonists, but I always felt that they were very close to achieving something like this.
What do you think about voiced protagonists or silent protagonists?
I think there's room for everything. It just depends. Is it in service to your vision or the experience that you want to create? As a general rule, I would say it tends for me to make more sense to have a voiced protagonist if you're going to have one in a third-person game than in a first-person game, because at least the camera is showing you someone. In a first-person game, the implication is that it's you, which is where it gets stranger, at least for me, when you try and say, it's you, but it's also this other person. That's tougher. But other people have found solutions, and other people appreciate it, so I can only talk to my personal beliefs and preference. I don't think it's something that is necessarily a hard and fast rule.
So you're saying you did not play Fallout 4 in third person mode?
No, I did not.
Jill, do you have any extra thoughts?
This year I've worked on a couple of VR games that are narrative and in the first person, and it's sort of interesting to see people start with the assumptions that they already have, and then somehow just sticking the game there on your face, it changes things. And one of the things it changes is that you really cannot have right now with the technology that we have. It's really weird if you have a first-person protagonist who speaks, because I think like the world is right up there in your face, and it feels like you are the camera and you're right there in the world. And if so, a voice comes, there's no way to make a voice sound like it's coming out of you. Which actually I think would be a really interesting thing to make a game about. You just embrace that and intentionally have this weird experience where you're talking and it's not you and you can't make the voice stop. That would be kind of rad. But so there are these forced silent protagonists because we cannot resolve the problem of speaking in VR. So I think we're going to see like a little rash of games where people come up with all kinds of creative ways to justify why their character isn't speaking.
You just gave a good segue to talk about VR, Jill. So, what's been writing for VR like? Been like?
Well, strange for me because I am that person that gets extremely nauseated very fast. With the headsets on. It does seem to be improving a little bit with new technology, but I have like a history of migraines and of light sensitivity and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of, like, I can't test a lot of VR because like I physically cannot test it. And something that I've learned is that like what the game is and how it moves is actually a lot more important than which technology you're using. Because I've played games like within the same tech, but the games work differently, and some of them are actually surprisingly fine. Like I could do it for like 20-30 minutes at a time, and then other ones Like, I put it on, it asks you to do the first thing that it asks you in the game, and, like, I get so much vertigo that I feel like I'm going to fall through a hole in the floor, and I just start, like, waving my arms and asking for help. So it's been weird because, you know, like, as a woman in games, I hate it when people are like, but do you play games? Because obviously I play games. It's, like, the thing that occupies the most of my time. And here I find myself at a juncture of my career where the most work that I'm finding just at the moment is in a medium that I physically cannot fully engage with.
Has that been, like, the biggest problem for you? Or have there been any other writing problems that you've encountered that you didn't expect?
No, it's actually been fun. And what's nice about working with teams who are working with new technologies is how open and excited they are and willing to try things. And it pushes them to go in new directions, even if they start from a common point. And so from that perspective, I've been loving the VR work.
Corey, are you interested at all in VR?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I see it, I think, a little differently than other people. Maybe I'm wrong, and other people see it this way too. But it seems right now it's being treated more as a peripheral or as a way to extend or enhance an experience. And I see it as being something totally separate and different, that VR has as much of a relationship to games as something like film or a novel, that they exist within the broader umbrella, I guess, of the entertainment industry. And VR probably has tons of other practical applications, even beyond that. But that I worry a little bit that we're going to fall into that same trap where, just like for a very long time, we looked for, well, it works in movies, maybe it'll work in games. I worry that we'll say now, well, it works in games, it'll work in VR, and that it's more radically different than I think most people realize. And so that's both interesting, but also worries me a little bit. I need to see what some of these fledgling efforts, look like and how things begin to take shape. And I think there's going to be a real challenge, especially since we keep putting controllers into people's hands when they use VR, that there's going to be an expectation of movement and being able to move through spaces in the same way, which is very challenging. It took me a long time when I put on the Vive.
Yeah.
Because every now and then you would be tempted. And it was really true for me. It was most true for me when they showed the Portal demo. And I don't know if you've seen that. At one point, you're in a room and everything's working great. And it's truly amazing. And it's the second best thing that I've seen from them outside of the Paint program. And it's all going really well. And then the walls come down at one point and you see you're in this vast space and you want to maybe start to move forward in it because you suddenly have this unprecedented control and scope of interaction. And you very quickly can wind up getting tangled up, or walk outside of the box. So I think that's why you'll also see maybe initial efforts focusing on keeping you inside things. I really want to try, for example, one of the flight sims, because I feel like that's a good solution. It puts you in a place where you are immobilized and it's the vehicle that's moving. So I suspect we'll see a bunch of stuff that involves vehicles going forward.
Yeah. I've been working on Time Machine VR with Minority Media, and I think one of the things that makes that game one of the ones that I can play is that you're basically in a claustrophobic little submarine that can only move at a gentle speed. And the feeling of being underwater is so analogous to the feeling of having a VR headset on that it feels natural. I had a huge... That Aperture Labs demo on the HTC Vive is the one I had the hardest time with. I think, like, it asks you to just put a battery into a charger, and just the motion of moving my arm through the virtual space, I almost fell over. But then in the same device, the paint, I can't remember what it's called, but the one where you can paint in the air, I thought was like one of the more extraordinary things I've ever seen. And that's like, it's amazing because it's beautiful. You know instinctively what to do. You feel right away how it's different from painting on a flat surface. You start to imagine all these applications for like, oh, well, if I can like model things directly in 3D space and then 3D print them, and you know, you can start to really see the potential in it. And then for me, most importantly, there are no cues in it that suggest that you need to move or that there is any kind of space that you need to map to absolutely, unlike the Aperture one where there's like just the fact of having a counter, like a tabletop that I have to reach to, was enough to completely throw off all of my internal systems. But it's been extremely, something I've really enjoyed is just talking to designers who are learning to adapt everything they know from non-VR video games to VR, and just kind of like watching their minds explode as they realize like all this stuff that's different and how much stuff needs to change, and like just how excited they get over every little failure on the way to understanding. And from that perspective, I just think that's like the most amazing spirit to be able to approach anything with. And with a lot of traditional games and more traditional teams, where things have kind of like calcified into like, we need this release schedule and it needs to make this much money. It's like natural for that openness and like thrill of failure to leave you. So I'm like really grateful to VR for kind of like bringing that risk enthusiasm back into the process.
Switching out from VR for a little bit, you are also working on Moon Hunters, Jill.
Yeah.
And it is a procedural action RPG, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's single player or multiplayer. It works both ways.
How has it been writing a procedural game like that? And yeah, we'll start with that.
Oh man, there are so many reasons that working on Moon Hunters is different from anything I've done before. One of it is just that Tanya Short has developed so much of it already, and she has such a distinct voice, and that voice is so peppy. Like, exclamation points just flow out of her, and you believe it, and you don't edit them out. It just feels natural to her writing and to her worlds, and so kind of adapting myself to be able to add content to that has been pretty interesting. Unfortunately, I just get to work directly with her, so it's not too tough. And then as for the way the game works, it's made to be played over and over again, kind of like in like maybe, like when I've played it, I've played it through in maybe 45 minute sessions. So it gets to be like playing a match of a game. And there are certain, you know, plot points that you'll hit each time, but then your experience is different, between those and with the ultimate outcome. The game sort of shows you later, like it tells you what your myth is that you built by playing. And so to me, the way it ends up working is like those plot points, the first time or two times that you see them, you know, they're unfamiliar and fresh. And then after that, they become more like, you know, like the like intermissions and penalties in sports. So it's like the first time you see a soccer game and you don't know what's going on. And then the second time you watch it, you're like aware of when halftime comes, you know, the teams are going to switch sides. And so I think in procedural games, there's an opportunity to use plot as these kind of like orienting benchmarks, the same way we have those things in sports. At least I know that's the way I've been thinking of it. It's the closest thing I can think of as a repeatable experience that generates different outcomes. And if you talk to people who are really heavily into sports, oftentimes they're not into what you expect, and the way they'll tell the stories of their sports is like full of drama and characters. And it's not as much about winning and competing for people. And so I think that procedural narrative games might occupy kind of like a similar space in terms of how they occupy our time and our imaginations.
What have the challenges been like? Like, what's the hardest thing for you to wrap your head around? Or what was the hardest thing?
I don't know about hard, but like, when I worked for a long time in AAA games, you have your tools that you use, and then you have other people doing all of the other jobs. And something I always wanted was to be closer to the engine, and I have that now. But there, it means that, like, when you're working directly in Unity to write and implement the stories, you're actually doing a bit of design work at the same time. Like, so I'm, like, writing an event, and I'm, like, determining, like, what personality traits will happen and what rewards the player will get. And it's quite intricate working in the engine and just making sure that everything is lined up the way it's supposed to. So it's not only compelling, but that it works, and it's not going to cause somebody else a lot of extra work to, like, fix anything that you kind of did wrong because you didn't have the same understanding of how the engine works. That's probably been the trickiest thing.
And Corey, I'm not sure if you have worked on or are currently working on something procedural-based game, but are you interested in those games at all?
I'm certainly interested in playing them. I spend a lot of time playing both Dwarf Fortress and Nemoria, which is sort of a ostensibly slightly more accessible version of it. And those games are completely 100% procedural. But I've always been curious, and I think it's really... I'm jealous that Jill gets to play around in that space. You know, I've never been able to wrap my head around what it's like creating narrative inside a space that is being procedurally generated. And so I don't know if I'd be curious to see what it's like to tackle that. But I just don't know enough, having never really worked on anything procedural, to know or to have anything of value to say at the moment. It seems like the kind of thing where it might be interesting to explore providing tools and writing stories for the world or the characters or places or objects you encounter in the world. So it's almost a more hands-off approach to narrative is what I would imagine it could be like. So rather than trying to create a story for the player to experience, you are creating a world and providing the player with a set of tools with which they can tell their own story.
No, that's exact. That's like the thesis of Moonhunters.
Yeah.
We will link to Moonhunters again in the show notes since we talked about it a good amount with Tani when she was on the show. Corey, in the past, you've said that you worked with user research and playtest labs to come up with new ways to analyze narrative. What were you looking at and what did you discover?
So was working a lot with a good friend of mine, and he felt that we should be data-informed instead of data-driven. So the idea would be to collect information and then discuss the information rather than take the information and fashion it into something that supports or refutes preconceived notions. So one of the things that you know I was having... challenging time with was being able to take a look at works in progress or discuss with people the stuff that they were doing. And so we came up with what we thought would be a way to make people feel more comfortable about sharing the stuff they were working on by sharing it with other writers and designers rather than putting it out in front of a bunch of, you know, teenagers that got recruited to come in and share their opinions, because not particularly helpful a lot of times when it comes to talking about story. The traditional playtesters can tell you if they liked something or didn't like something, hopefully, but conversations beyond that were oftentimes very difficult. So we sought to adapt the process so that it would be tailored to writers and designers inside the studio. And we were looking for patterns, and it was really, at least in the beginning, just about that. So everyone would read through stuff, and we would look to see if people, you know, what people liked and what people didn't like, and then see if there were patterns emerging. You know, if one person takes issue with a character, then that's probably just a subjective personal preference issue. If, you know, 11 out of 12 people are having a really hard time understanding why something happened, then we could at least say, hey, you may want to take a look at this. And it was just that. It was, it's been a while since we've done one, so I'm sure I'm leaving plenty of stuff out. But the idea was just to create a platform through which we could attempt to use some amount of data to see what people liked and didn't like. And then the entire second half would be creating a workshop session, ideally with other writers from the same project, to just talk about the things that we had discovered. So again, it wasn't us coming in and saying, here's what you need to fix and here's how to fix it. It was much more, we're noticing that people are having some issues with X, Y, and Z. Let's all sit down together and talk for a few hours and see, you know, what comes out of it. So it was very casual. It wasn't meant to be scary or you know, prescriptive, I suppose. But it was meant to facilitate discussion and encourage collaboration, because sometimes people, you know, writers may want to do more work but don't have the opportunity, or someone else on the project will say, no, it's fine as it is. And this would allow us to get people the time and space in a perfect world to further workshop stuff. So we were kind of backing into the idea of creating a writer's room, which unfortunately don't exist as often as I'd at least personally like to see them exist during productions.
That sounds extremely sensible.
Yeah, you'd be surprised though how much of a challenge it still proved to be. When it worked and when people wanted to do it, it was actually a pretty enjoyable process, if not slightly time consuming. But yeah, I liked it. I miss it. I hope one day I'll get to do something like that again. And again, you have to be willing, right? Not everyone likes to work within that kind of framework. So you have to find people that want to do it, that are comfortable doing it. And yeah.
Was that what was challenging about making that happen? Finding the people?
It was always different. Sometimes people that had nothing to do with the narrative wouldn't see the value in it. Sometimes people on the narrative team, for various different reasons, wouldn't necessarily want to participate. And it doesn't feel to me like the kind of thing that you want to force people to do. Because it's rare, I think, especially in creative endeavors, that forcing people to do something that they're not comfortable with isn't probably going to create the greatest output. Although I've heard other people often quote that pressure makes diamonds, but I think there's a difference between pressure and pain, and I don't know that I necessarily agree that pressure makes diamonds.
It also makes explosions.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Pressure makes a lot of things.
Like a bloody mess if you squeeze something that's like not meant to be squeezed too hard. So, yes. So, in my mind, it was a tool that was there for people that wanted to use it, but I think that it's not the kind of thing that you'd necessarily want to force on. Everyone has a different process too, right? So, in a perfect world, we'd have been able to find a way to tailor it to different personalities or needs or comfort zones. Because again, one of the things I think that's really important, or that I found, is that I think people produce better work when they're happy and comfortable and feel... and don't feel vulnerable, right? Because a lot of times, or feel okay with being vulnerable. Because at least for me, again, maybe I'm projecting, like it's a very, what's the word? It's a very sensitive topic, or it can be a very difficult thing. It's like to take your work and put it in front of, you know, a large group of people and then have them sit there in judgment. It doesn't always feel good. And you just have to sometimes, at least for me, when I start to feel that way, or, you know, insecure or defensive, that it's usually hopefully for a good purpose, that I don't care where the good idea comes from, only that the good idea is there at the end of the day.
Related to this, for both of you, what do you think are the biggest problems in storytelling in the video games? Which is a huge question, but what comes to mind first?
Rushing, not taking the time to just sit quietly and develop characters. Like if you're on a team where you have to justify all of your decisions before you make them, you're probably never going to arrive at your best material. And that comes back to what Corey was saying about vulnerability and I think safety. And I think people need the freedom to take time to think and to make mistakes. Without facing, you know, harsh reprimands. And that's just how story works.
Do you think people rush maybe because they're not given enough of a leeway with scheduling?
People rush, well, no, but I think people, why do the writers rush? Because they're kind of squished between design and often cinematics or whatever else it takes to ship the game. And so that when the design process goes long, which it always does, because naturally designers want to take their time to make sure they have all their ducks in a row before finalizing it. But when design runs long, writing runs out of time. Very rarely does anybody put the brakes on and say, hey, like, the writers need as much time as the designers do. And with all, with, if there have been changes, then maybe we should give more time to story. So writers end up pinched, and because there's no time, now they have to justify what they're doing before they've had time to maybe think through it and become completely comfortable and try out all of the options. Anytime there's money, people are going to start to get nasty. It's just how it works. Some indie teams are able to overcome this by just having it built into their philosophy of work that they know that they're not going to get more money by freaking out. But I think freaking out is the first and most natural human reaction to any kind of stress. And that, like, passing the buck sort of down the chain to the next person is also a very natural reaction. And unless you really, really want to protect stories, it's not going to happen because it takes so much will.
Corey, what are your thoughts?
I don't know that there is sort of one singular issue facing everyone. You know, like I was saying before, I think every project, I think every place, I think every personality is different. So each and every game, I think, has its own, you know, advantages and challenges or opportunities and challenges. So I couldn't say it's any one thing. I think it's a couple of things that I already talked about. I think that there's often a sense that, a general sense, whether people realize it or not, that they're making software and not entertainment, and that narrative is a very important part of creating entertainment. And I think that a lot of times people also continue to think that when we say narrative, we mean the words in a script, and it's oftentimes so much more than that. And a lot of people just have preconceived notions that a game writer or a game narrative director is only concerned with the words on the page, when oftentimes they're concerned with everything else as well. And so then it's just a matter of finding time to communicate and show, rather than just say, that you really are on the same side. And then, but the problems on every production are different. Sometimes you'll be on a project that suffers from weak or non-existent creative vision, right? And that's a much larger problem than just the problem being faced by the writer. But it can oftentimes put the writer in an awkward place, yeah, because they're expected to perform or create, but there's no guidance. And the absolute worst is when you're stuck with someone that won't offer anything except a bunch of no, that's not it. So you're then just creating and sending it out there, and like, maybe it's going to be right this time. And that can become very frustrating very quickly. Or you'll have a creative director that's really more of a salesperson. And so they're off doing other stuff, and there is not as much guidance or direction. But again, like, every project is different. I think that time is obviously a problem. It's always a problem. I think it's a problem for everyone. Like Jill had said, it would be nice if other people on the team recognized that we needed a little bit more time and space than we normally get. I think one way to overcome that is to force people to make decisions and then live with them as early as possible. I think you're better off trying to make the best version of an okay idea than to spend all of that time searching for a better idea, because what I found is that there probably is no better idea. There's a different idea, sure.
Yeah.
And some people may think it's better. But then what happens is that all that time that could have been spent making a good idea great has now been lost trying to change a good idea into another idea that's, like, probably not any better. And sometimes
absolutely.
So, and that's really hard, because that gets back to, like, the fear and control thing. Like, when you ask someone to commit, and if there's, like, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on the line, it's sort of like the last thing that anyone wants to do. So they wait for as long as possible before they say, okay, this is what we're doing. And a lot of times, this is what we're doing is only because there's no time to do anything else. But it's hard. It's really hard to fight against that that voice in the back of your head that's like, well, there's still 2 years left. Like, why don't we just spend a couple of months making sure this is the best idea? And I don't know how you prevent that short of having someone on the team that says, no, you have no choice. This is what we're doing, and if you don't like it, leave. But I don't know. That would probably create its own host of problems. So there's no answer, and there's no singular problem, unless you want to say just like people. People are a problem.
Yeah.
So there's nothing we can do about it. We just have to find solutions, communicate as openly and as often as possible, but like be okay with like taking risks. You're not going to die. That's what we all forget, at least hopefully. Maybe it's not the best thing in the world, but like I can think of far worse things. But we're always afraid. So am I. So it's not like I'm blameless or above it.
This is going like to the middle of your answer, but for both of you, how do you deal in a situation where you're not getting the direction you need or want from like a creative director who is absent or preoccupied with something else?
I haven't found the answer to that. I worked with someone who would make decisions and then go on vacation and tell me that I had to announce the decision to the team. So that the team would hear it from me for the first time, and they would develop the opinion that that the creative director and I had been doing things behind their back. And I would say, well, no, I just learned this 5 minutes ago, and I'm bringing it to you as quickly as possible so that we can, if necessary, take it apart and look at it and see what it means and come back with the right recommendations. When you're put in a position like that, you've lost before you've even begun. I could probably understand people thinking like, oh, you've just been like scheming behind our backs this whole time. I could probably understand how they would feel that way. So I don't know. I'm inclined to think that if you have a creative director that's really not supporting you, or who's not volunteering ideas, or who can only say no and keep going until you find it, that you're probably never going to solve that situation. Those situations remind me, there's one of my favorite jokes on Cheers, you know, like the TV show, comes from one of those little segments that they did before the show starts. And there was one where, for some reason, Norm had volunteered to be a volunteer driver in like a drunk driving program. And so there's this guy who's completely sloshed, and he needs to take him home. And he asks the guy, like, okay, where do you live? And they're, you know, about to step out of the bar into Greater Boston. And the guy says, oh, it's the Blue House. You'll know it when you see it. I think that on occasion, situations can end up like that. And at that point, I don't know, you either commit to just driving until you see a blue house, or to like, you're going to get in the car with this guy and you're just keep talking to him until you figure out how to read his clues and do what he needs you to do. Or you can just be like, you know what, maybe I should have just stayed in the bar and got sloshed too, because this is crazy.
Corey, do you have anything else to add?
Only that I feel like I've been pretty fortunate that I haven't had to, that I haven't had anything truly horrific happen so far. But I think that if you're not getting what you need, then yeah, there again, there's no like one solution, right? You try, there's lots of different things you can try. I have no idea what will or won't work. Sometimes you can confront the person, which will be awkward and uncomfortable, but potentially could lead to something good. If that doesn't work, maybe you just try and find something you're excited about and hope that maybe that the thing that gets you excited will get other people excited as well, and then solve the problem before it can become one. But yeah, I don't know. If I ever wind up having to go through something like that, I'll let you know what I chose to do and if it worked or not.
I will say, you need to be very aware of your political position within the team, because depending what political capital you have or don't have, certain solutions might be very mature, but they're never going to work for you. Like, there are teams that are just never going to take any of your suggestions, but that can happen. And then there's other times, you know, if you can find that people that do support and understand you. You can work with them to sort of turn everything around, make everything better. But it starts with like understanding what your position is and what you're dealing with. If you're actually dealing with a situation where the only thing anyone will accept is for you to just, you know, stop trying and just do exactly what they're asking, even if it's a bad idea, or if you're in a situation where you have not just like the title of writer that should mean that you know what you're doing, the story, but that you also have like the political capital and trust of everyone around you to be able to carry things forward.
We'll try to transition to a happier subject as we wind down. Are there any books that you think either of you think that should be required reading for people working in the industry that aren't about game development specifically, and either for people working with narrative or just in general?
I think everyone should read really great memoirs written by people who are nothing like them. Like a couple weeks ago, I read a book called The Other Side of Paradise by Stacey Ann Chin, and it's about growing up poor and without parents, and you know, realizing and like just coming out hard that she was a lesbian. And I feel like reading about those kinds of experiences about people who are nothing like you is just the best thing you could do. There's like so much wisdom comes from people that do not share your perspective and experiences.
Yes, that's a perfect answer. Corey.
I've never read a how to make video games book, so I wouldn't be able to speak to them. They might be good, and there's quite a few of them out there, especially ones that focus on narrative and or design. But I just wouldn't know because I haven't looked at them, and I haven't read any of the other, like, you know, old standbys. I haven't read the Campbell thing. I haven't read the Sid Field thing. I haven't read the hot shit a few years ago, and I don't know if it still is, was Save the Cat. I never read it.
Oh God!
I just
no.
So I'm, but I'm just telling you, like,
we're gonna bleep that out.
I don't read
that cat where it is.
I would recommend just read a good book. And the more you read, maybe the more you'll come to understand storytelling. But I don't know enough about, and I personally am. I'm just not someone that's ever consumed the how-to books, so I'm the wrong person to ask. I really like what Jill said, though. It's something really cool about reading biographical stories about people that are nothing like you. So that's cool. I might try that. Thanks, Jill.
What about then, since you are a great consumer of TV, is there a TV show you think would be very instructional for game developers? Or would you say The West Wing?
Oh, I mean, everyone should be watching Rick and Morty, and that's
why,
because it's so good. It's like the best thing on TV. I also personally love it's best season, but The Good Wife is one of the greatest things on television, and they are masters when it comes to just the way they set up their stories and the way they're broken down. Again, I don't know if this is true, but someone was saying that what they would do is they would come up with the idea for an episode, and once they reach the end of the idea for the episode, they would say, okay, great, that's the middle of the episode, and now let's all go back into the room and find out like what would happen for the 30 minutes after that, which I thought was kind of cool.
That's so great.
And I have no idea if it's true, but it sounds really fucking cool, so I'm going to just end it. And I love the show, so I'm assuming that it's probably true, but I just thought that was so cool.
More games need to do that.
Idea. Yeah.
I think also,
I agree.
Like, the way they have one cast, more or less, and the way they kind of, like, Rubik's Cube them together into different configurations for each season, and it's, like, different plot points turn the drama is amazing. And I've been kind of, like, trying to rack my brain and be like, well, how can you build a game just out of the mechanics of, like, how social relationships change within groups? Like, that would be amazing.
Yes, it would. Please make that game.
I don't know if I'm actually smart enough to build the things that I think of.
You, You can homebrew that game, assuming it's still around, by joining a guild in World of Warcraft and participating as actively as possible with the people and their lives outside of the guild. You will then get to that. That is definitely something special, let me tell you. Very magical.
Oh, man, that's probably the best answer we've had in this thing.
Okay, last question. What are both you looking forward to in the future, and what's exciting you?
Because I'm running my own business, so looking at different revenue streams is important. Like, it's hard to actually run a good business that depends entirely on you doing all of the work. I've been looking at sort of building like virtual writers' rooms, so that I really like working with other writers. So that excites me. And then I'm also just thinking, you know, what a company really needs to survive. And so that, therefore, what a writer really needs to survive is probably their own IP. You need the revenue to come from stuff that you already made, not just from things that you're currently working on. So I'm excited about developing those two fronts.
Corey?
This is going to sound really lame, and I'm probably not the first person to say this, but I am excited to see what happens when kids that grew up playing games like Minecraft enter the video game sort of workforce space. Because they're going to be, it's just going to be a very different way, I think. We'll see. I could be totally wrong. Of approaching design, narrative, everything, really. And I'm curious to see if that helps, you know, take down some of those fear barriers that I was talking about, whether we have become the old conservatives. I hope not. I don't feel like an old conservative, but like maybe old conservatives don't feel like they're old conservatives. I don't know. Anyway, I'm just excited to see what happens when a bunch of people raised in an environment with more open and procedural experiences reach the point where they're going to start sharing their own ideas, and to see if there is sort of an influencing factor and if it changes the way that we approach some video game production.
I want to just quickly go back to Jill's answer. When we're talking about virtual writers' rooms, Jill, has it been difficult at all for the projects you worked on when you use virtual writers' room when all the writers are not in the same place or when they're not with the team?
No, that's been pretty easy, just thanks to like picking the right people and using tools like Slack and all of the sharing things that Google has to offer. The harder part is just I haven't actually proven whether there is enough demand in the market. Most clients you talk to want you doing all of the work, and so introducing them to the idea that maybe it doesn't have to be you, and that you could simply find another writer who might even be much better suited than you to do the work. It still remains to be seen whether that's something people actually go for. But I want them to go for it, because really nothing makes me happier than meeting a new writer that's already good, or finding a writer from maybe another genre who really wants to get into game writing and needs the right shot and is working with them closely. And giving them the skills that they have to just totally blow everyone out of the water, that I really enjoy that. So I'm hoping that if I just keep enjoying it and share my enjoyment of it, that people will start like wanting it from me. Yeah.
Good luck.
Thank you.
So with that, where can people find you two on the internet?
I'm on Twitter sometimes. It's, I think, at Rage Cave. Is that right? I think so.
I think so.
My Twitter feed is really boring. It's pictures of my cats. It's me saying the word vagina a lot. And that's about it. I'll occasionally post an article that I saw on Dig. So no one should get too excited. Unless you want to see pictures of my cats, which are fucking amazing.
So, he has really amazing cats. You probably do want to see Corey's cats.
So,
when I found your Twitter account for the first time, for a few days, I thought it wasn't you.
Yeah, I just, yeah. It's performance art, I guess. I don't know.
Is that why you post it all caps all the time?
No, I do it, and it's how I write. So, like, when I write by hand, not on the computer, I like the symmetry. It really is as simple as that. I just think that all caps looks better.
Jill, where can people find you on the internet?
I am on Twitter as Code Jill, CodeJill. Kind of like a code red, like a warning. And then also, my new website should be ready soon, and it has, I think, a really cool domain name, which is, it's like discoglobe.be, so it just says like Disco Globe, but with a dot, the last two letters.
But yeah, and this podcast is ScriptLockCast on Twitter. And that's it. Thank you two so much for coming with us and talking for a little while.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.